Okay, very good. Let us begin. Our first speaker is Dee Hodges. She is the president of the Maryland Taxpayers Association. She has been with the organization since 1998. She cut her political teeth on Ellen Sarbury's first gubernatorial campaign back in 1994 and was on the committee to enact a 24% tax cut. She has spent most of her professional life in banking. She's been a branch manager. She's been involved with credit, making all kinds of loans, mortgage loans, construction, personal business loans. She's a licensed stockbroker. She actually was in Vietnam in the late 60s and with the American Red Cross and was named an honorary member of the 1st Infantry Division. She's a graduate of the University of Illinois. She has her master's in finance from the University of Baltimore, and she's here to tell us today about how the budgeting process in Maryland works and what the heck the General Assembly is doing with our money. Please welcome Dee Hodges.
Thanks. I brought a whole bunch of backup stuff just in case I have to shuffle around. But I don't go well by, I don't listen to the regulations and that sort of thing. And Bob said, I should talk about how a bill is passed in Annapolis and then also how the budget compares to how a bill is passed. So we have 47 and we have 141 delegates. And so we have two houses, but it's interesting because, for the most part, there are three delegates who run in the same district as one senator. In some aspects, we're really a unicameral legislature. And we got that way when somebody at the Supreme Court decided that senators had to be elected according to an even amount of population rather than two senators per county and the city. And that really started messing us up in Maryland, to tell you the truth. The way laws get passed, this year there are about 3,500 proposals out there. A lot of them were pre-filed. They can be pre-filed in late November or December. And then this outfit called Legislative Services will write up the legalese to the laws. So they come out. Every proposal has to be heard by a committee. The committees all have subcommittees. So these different laws heard by the committees will be divided up among those subcommittees. Typically, if one of these things is voted out of the subcommittee, it will be taken to the floor. A lot of times the chairman of the committee can prevent it from having a vote at all, and that's just the way it works. But everybody in Maryland can testify. If you feel strongly about it, you can go down there, sign up and testify. You usually have to sign up between 11:30 and 12:30 if you have written testimony. Give it to them, give it to the committee offices at that time. Then they distribute it to the legislators in the folders. So bills, once they get out of committee, once they get out of the House floor or the Senate, if they get out of the House floor and they're passed there, they will go over to the Senate. Sometimes a twin bill is sponsored in each House, and then it can be a little easier, but sometimes the bill will go over to the other House if it passes. But sometimes you have amendments in each House, so you have to, if that has to go to a committee where you kind of settle it out and then decide whether you're going to vote to pass the bill in total. The budget is a little bit different. I'm a finance person. We all have family budgets. We all know what we have to spend. But in a way, corporate budgets are based on a lot whether you're making money or whether you're not making money. And if you're not making money, you have to figure out ways that you can squeeze your profits or your nonprofits and lighten up, but still keep in business until and hopefully eventually expand. If you are making money, you have to decide where you're going to invest so that you can expand or improve what you're already doing. In the legislature, I don't think it's really that way. It's really whether they estimate that they're going to bring in more revenues with all the taxes and the fees that they have. If they feel like they're going to bring in more revenues, then, hey, it's Katie bar the door. They're going to spend more money. But then if we hit a recession and they know all these people are getting laid off and the revenues aren't going to be as high, they're still going to spend more money. It's the idea of kings. That's the general reaction, especially in a one-party blue state. Republicans after Ronald Reagan, I think, were a lot better. But they still can lose it. So we always have to keep reminding them. That's why the Maryland Taxpayers Association sponsors the No New Taxes Pledge, which Americans for Tax Reform also sponsors. And we're going to be sending those out to all of the congressional candidates. Probably most of the Republicans will sign. Most of the Democrats will not, if any. But anyway, if we're in a recession and they aren't bringing in that much money, they'll just raise taxes on the people who are working and on the businesses. So that makes it even harder for the businesses to get going again. The legislature does not work in any predictive way in a dynamic. They don't look at society as dynamic and that there can be real growth in society. If it's growing, they're happy, they'll spend more. But their predictions on, or their estimates on how much a bill is going to cost are, usually that we have to add more people to the government and so forth and so on. And then they're required to give out a small business opinion, whether it will be a substantial problem for them or a minimal problem for them, but nothing more about small business. So it just keeps going on day after day until finally the session is over and we have at least 700 bills, 700 to 800 bills that have been passed and go to the governor's desk. If they are vetoed, they will go back to the legislature for to see if they will be overridden. And as you know, a couple of bills were overridden. The budget is a little different. I told you about the psychology of it, but already the state has come out with revenue estimates that we are bringing in less money than we thought we were bringing in. But we probably already know that. The stock market is going down. Businesses, their profits are down. I just heard this morning that ships, that travel between Asia and America and Europe and America and so forth, there aren't as many ships running over the oceans. When transportation is down, it's an indication that other things are not necessarily very good. So, anyway, they are being warned that a little less money is coming in. So they're starting to get worried. Well, they keep reporting this, not necessarily every month, but they will report. And by the time October comes along, they're reporting every month. And by late November or early December, the Spending Affordability Committee meets, which is a legislative body. And they will estimate really how much they can raise spending. But the governor submits the budget. The governor in Maryland is the most powerful governor in the country, because that budget gets submitted and the legislature cannot increase the budget. They can only decrease it. So this is what they do to get around it. They create all these mandates. So this year there are several mandates, mandate proposals out there for this little fund or that little fund, that this amount of money has to go in that fund every year, and that will increase the mandated spending. Consequently, Governor Hogan has put out an administration bill to start to get the mandates under control. If the mandates represent 83% of spending, and they can go up by COLAs every year, it's a very dangerous situation. And a lot of this, if I can shuffle through my papers, I might give an example, but a lot of these things are things you've never even heard of. Probably things that were put in there 30 years ago and really don't matter anymore. And there's no zero-based budgeting. So I understand that some programs get refunded year after year, but they don't even exist anymore. So, you know, it's kind of like slush. The tolls. I live in a part of Baltimore where I go through the tunnels constantly. And the tolls are killing us. I mean, even if you have an easy pass and it's $3 a throw, if you don't go through regularly, you get your statement and all of a sudden you see $325 charges to your credit card. It's not fun. The tolls have typically and for decades been used as slush for other departments. There are a lot of jobs that are open. People don't exist in those jobs, but they fund those jobs anyway, more slush. So Maryland pays more per capita to state government than any of the states surrounding us. So Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, you pay less in those states than you do in Maryland. The interesting part about the budget is if they pass a mandate, then that adds to these mandates. Hopefully there will be no more passed, although there are a couple of bills for mandates. This year. What Hogan wants to do is to stop the increase in money to the mandates by fiscal year 1919. And he also wants, and you know, this is a reasonable bill for 83% of the budget. And he also wants that if a new mandate is passed, then an old mandate has to be taken out of equal amount, so that there will be no increase in the mandates and government has a little more flexibility to serve us, which is really what we want. And I think that far too often that's what they forget. So that is your basics about the budget, except that when it is passed, and it's supposed to pass a week before when the session is over, once it passes, because the governor proposed it, he doesn't sign it. It just passes into law. This year, the governor filled all of the required mandates. There was no discussion about whether any of the mandates could be left out. So there will be no what they call a BRFA, Budget Reconciliation and Financing Act, to put more money in the budget to fund those. So hopefully we'll be in a position where we can really cut taxes. Because I, as a banker, even in the late 70s, I remember sitting in the office of a regional oil company, and I was with the senior vice president who was in charge of the region, and he said, Dee, as soon as I retire, we're pulling out. As I recall, it was what is now Exxon today, but they had a regional headquarters here. There were a lot of oil companies here. And he said, frankly, Maryland is anti-business. Well, how did all this happen? Maryland has a really rich history. We know that George Washington gave up his commission right in the State House. The Treaty of York to end the Revolution was signed in the stone basement below the Maryland Inn. And the group that called for a group to create a new constitution, that call came from Annapolis. So we started out having a lot to be proud of. We got to the Civil War, and we were still a southern state. We had a lot of plantations. We had, in this area, there was a lot of iron ore, and slaves were being used to mine iron ore and smelt it. And so there was a lot of southern sympathy, I think possibly more than northern. Northern troops were put in here, trained in here. The first skirmish was actually fought in Baltimore City when the troops walked from one train station to the next train station. But they brought them in here to keep Maryland free because they didn't want D.C. to fall to the south. So anyway, you can see that we had a lot of disagreements going each way. So after the Civil War, when we had all of the Reconstruction going on, Maryland, which had already been Democrat, became even more Democrat. But a lot of these people were pretty conservative. So we get to, I call it the 19-teens, 1913, 1916. I think the two worst bills for both our federal government and our state governments had to do with the creation of an income tax and the direct election of senators. The senators then were no longer had to come under the direction of the state. States lost their federalization kind of influence with the government gradually after that. And nobody thought too much of the income tax until it started getting bigger. And I can remember my father in the 50s cursing every year when he's paying the income taxes. My grandparents moved to Bethesda looking for a place to invest money to create a school. And he decided Maryland over Virginia because Maryland's taxes were lower. The very next year, Maryland passed an income tax. And I think that was 1937 or 38. And then we passed in 1948 a sales tax. And there was a governor, Lane. I think he was an incumbent governor, but he lost his reelection bid. They called him Penny Lane because everybody was so mad about that. But if you think about, really, how the states became subjects of the federal government, it really began with all of these nice things that the federal government took on. After World War II, we were rich. All of a sudden, these soldiers were coming back. We had rationing in World War II, and people had all this savings. And they invested like crazy. We had a big real estate boom in the 50s, and we overcame the huge deficit. We had a deficit that was really as big as our GDP then, and we didn't outgrow the deficit. We outgrew the GDP. So by 1960, we were sitting pretty. We had already started aid to dependent children in the late 40s or early 50s, but Jack Kennedy was in office and he was martyred. So Johnson took full advantage of everything, and what did he pass? He passed all kinds of social welfare programs, which meant that young women could be, didn't have to be married. In fact, they couldn't be married. But if they had children, they were going to be supported. Those children were going to be supported. And then food stamps and everything took off from there. Medicare and Medicaid was passed in the 60s, and it just kept multiplying. Social Security was already popular, and they kept increasing the benefits for Social Security. Today, most of the fraud in Social Security comes in people claiming that they've got medical problems and that they need it early. So the government, the federal government, got bigger and bigger, and as they got bigger and bigger, in order to quote-unquote fill their constitutional duty, they were saying, okay, you states come along with us, we're going to subsidize you for a few years or maybe forever, but you're going to haul your own weight too. So the states started getting bigger and bigger, and here we are. So as far as the budget goes, I'm supposed to talk about the budget. And in a way, I kind of hate the budget, but I passed out on these tables these sheets. It has the last 10 years of revenue and then the last 10 years of expenses. So I'm looking at the revenue. And we can see what actually happened in the during the O'Malley years. Poor O'Malley, but maybe I hope he's enjoying his furniture. But in 2007, he passed some huge tax increases. The corporate tax went up from 7%, which was already high in competition with the states. It went up to 8.25%. The income taxes started being graduated more up to 5.75%. And the sales tax went up another percent, or 20% really, to 6%. So, and I think the cigarette tax went up then. So anyway, we have a lot of smuggling and cigarettes, but all the way through 2014 for the income tax, we had actually had a net loss in receipts on the income tax. And if you look on the revenue side, up in the second category, you'll see a double line, and then you'll see a second category, and it says income taxes. Well, after 2012, the income tax haul started really being bigger, but it wasn't big enough to overcome all the losses that it had had, because the legislature had passed those horrible tax increases and people weren't working. And it made it even harder for people to work in Maryland. So I think the reason why we have a Republican governor today, and I know this is a Libertarian Party, and I know that Republicans and Libertarians talk a lot back and forth. And I think the reason we won is because the state was so fed up with everything as usual. So finally, in the fiscal 2015, on debt, the income taxes came out higher. That was because in 2012, the legislature passed another huge income tax on the personal income tax that really hit the middle class that had been working for a while. So their incomes were up to, say, if you were single, up to $100,000. If you were married, and both of you were making $75,000 there. I wanted to point this out, to point out how stupid some of these decisions can be, and how in our Spending Affordability Committee and other things, we don't review what we've done that have actually hurt the citizens. And our legislators more pro the government than they are pro us. If they're pro us, I think the government will do just fine. You know, when I think about the welfare system, it was there were work requirements after a certain number of years in the welfare system in the 1990s because of the Republican Congress. And then Obama, by edict, said that we're not going to do these work requirements anymore. Well, more people had jobs and fewer people were taking welfare, just very gradually, but it was starting to happen. And anyway, then it just started going up again. And of course, we were in a recession, so it was going up again. But right next to it, when I think of what has happened to Maryland, in the 70s, the government, I think, decided that it could really rely on the D.C. suburbs because so many of those were federal employees. And we had started to lose the big manufacturers. Bethlehem Steel had a 125,000 population in around 1950. We watched more Liberty ships from the port of Baltimore than any other port in the country. We had so much to be proud of, but then we lost it. And Baltimore County, where I live, it's the second most aging county in the country. And people say, oh, I didn't know that before. How many of you knew that? Well, I figure it's because all of those jobs, all of those really good jobs that went away in the 70s and early 80s, those people had to leave the state. And the ones that are left are the ones that are aging. They were able to continue work. And I started going door to door and asking a few people if they had children. And out of three children, they would say, typically, that one might be in an outer county like Harford County or Carroll County or Frederick, and the other one child might be in Virginia, particularly Northern Virginia, and then the other one was in Texas. Why Texas? All kinds of businesses going there. No state income taxes. So I don't know how long I've gone on, but I want you to look at these forms and see about the sales tax. When I went to 10 years before this and 10 years before that, I suspect had they never raised the sales tax, we'd be getting the same amount of money today that we got with an increased sales tax. If you look at the back of the sheet, look at the areas where we have spent a lot of money. Look under health care. And I do have glasses for fine print. I was bragging that when I had my cataracts removed, I got 20/20 eyesight. But in certain light, I need my glasses. Anyway, health care, second line, almost doubled. Education. Look how that has increased. And do most of us think education has gotten any better? Does anybody like Common Core? I think this is one of the worst things about the city. The city spends $17,500 per student per year, and that isn't even counting the capital budget. And what do those kids get out of it? And as far as I could tell from the riots in the spring, these kids are still being bussed all over the city. When most of the public schools are, the city is 66% black, and there are white people in public schools and so forth, but it seems unnecessary to continue this bussing. And it's an expense. Well, during the riots in the spring, if you will remember, the mayor shut down the Mondawmin Transit Center. So these kids couldn't even get home.
Why not be in the riot, or why not observe the riot? And you know there are a lot of kids observing those riots, if you looked at it on TV.
Now, should I open this up to some questions? If I don't know how much time I have left.
Supplemental budget process works. I understand that the governor puts out the budget, and then they're putting out a second and a third supplemental.
The supplemental budget only happens, that's the BRFA, the Budget Reconciliation and Financing Act. That only happens if the mandates are not proposed to be fully funded. Got that? So O'Malley didn't fund mandates all the mandates every year. Hogan funded all of the mandates this year because he didn't want to go through that.
They have to
ostensibly
balance the budget every year.
They're required to balance the budget. But remember, one way to balance the budget is to go out on debt. And this is something I didn't mention. Currently, we're spending about $250 million on interest. We require on our regular general obligation bonds and so forth, we have to go out only 15 years, which is a good thing, because if we went out 30 years, then that would make our required payments lower, and they could go out and get even more debt. But during the O'Malley years, they went to debt a lot, and they relied on the extra money coming from the federal government, which they got. So that's really how they did it. It was with a wink and a nod is how they did it. But they doubled the interest payments over those years. And it is expected that if interest rates go up, the interest payments could be doubled again by 2020. I talked to somebody in the Department of the Budget yesterday, and that's what he told me. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
You said earlier that after World War II, that we outgrew our debt to the GDP. Is that right? And I'm just wondering, do you think that we're in a position that our country could ever outgrow or pay off some debt that we're in now? How does it compare now to where we're at World War II?
I would say it's kind of similar. Our GDP is similar to the total debt that we see, not the unfunded liabilities. On the federal level, I did a paper once in grad school on Social Security, and there are about 30 countries around the world that have started to have people own their own pension accounts or Social Security accounts, and those already on it could choose whether to go on the new plan or not. But I really believe that Social Security recipients should, not the recipients, but the people, the payroll taxes, they should go to their own accounts that they own. Otherwise, we'll never be sure that we're going to get this money. A lot of Social Security, a lot of the extra funds were used to expand the government. So between that and the income taxes, they were rolling in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s. Under Ronald Reagan, spending increased, even though we got back to having a rollicking economy because taxes were lower. So I think what a lot of people don't understand is that when taxes and regulations are a form of tax, when they're less oppressive, then the energies of people get going again, and it's our people individually, the good old American ingenuity that has always made this country run, not some government bureaucrat directing the masses. And you know, there's that dichotomy and
and where it doesn't make sense to a lot of people that if they cut taxes and they have a big debt, that, yeah, the government will actually bring in more money, which it does. There was an economist, Say, during the Reagan years. His name was Say, S-A-Y. And he concluded that cutting taxes in 1 year meant the government would have more money than it had before. It would take that year to gear it all up. I don't know if it would take a year now. I think we have to cut regulations big time. And I think all of us are concerned about the environment. I know I am. But I don't want to be paying out money for things that are totally uneconomical, because the U.S., I mean, our business runs on electricity. We all run on electricity. And we need to rely on cheap electricity. Windmills are really expensive, and they kill birds, and when they're broken down, I understand the racket they make is awful. And I understand if you're outside near them, it's like a huge vacuum cleaner. But solar is coming along, but it's not yet economical. I understand that if you get solar, you pay for it for 10 years, then you need to replace it in 10 years, so you're paying for it again. So solar needs to be able to extend that time to make it truly economical. Yeah.
I was listening to Mr. O'Malley speak when it's state to state. He used the phrase recession driving revenue. Now, were revenues down that much, you know, say 2008, 2009, 2010, that they really put a crimp into, you know, spending or what I would say tax collection, or could have been spent if they continued off with the
actually
state, that it wouldn't have, you know, we might not have had to battle with
The first big tax increases that I described were in a special session in the fall of 2007. It was the first half of fiscal 2008. We were not officially in recession yet. As a banker, I realized that the last awful requirement for the Basel rules for how banks counted their money what went into effect in November 9th, which may have been the last day of the legislature after they passed those awful bills. Well, those rules said that all banks had to value their loans that they sold, and they had sold a lot of mortgages out. They had to value those mortgages on the lowest price paid. Well, mortgages, for instance, are secured on property. If, say, you make a mortgage for $100,000 and the property is worth $120,000 or $125,000, what do you have to worry about? Why should you value that loan at $20,000? And that's what was happening. So when those banks started staggering by spring, it started becoming clear. Spring 2008, and then in the summer of 2008, there were runs on some banks, and then in September, they had the big conclave, and they were going to save all these banks. There were some banks that didn't want to be saved, but they were forced. I think Wells Fargo really didn't need it, and they asked not to take it, but they were forced to take it because it was a really big bank. So what was the rest of the question? Did I get it?
Well,
it was before.
Keeping it up with O'Malley's, I guess, spending plan to spend that as bad as the, you know, people made him out to be, or would he, you know, would he have had the revenue? I mean, he might have increased
the Keynesian idea is that in a recession you need to spend more. We were really clear that we were in a recession the year after they passed those income taxes, and he had already cleared out a lot of the special funds, so he needed more money, and he did need some more money,
like people were becoming unemployed in 2009. So they did need more money out of certain funds to do it. So they just continued to tack on taxes. The millionaire's tax came at that time. And I looked it up. There were 2,000 fewer millionaires even reporting taxes in that following year because it was easy to leave the state. So what they did was they lost money on the millionaire's tax. Their problem is that the state, when it makes a big mistake, it just sits on it or it just exacerbates it with another tax, and that's what they did. They kept exacerbating and exacerbating and spending it up. And I have to say, spending didn't go up by as much of a percentage as it did in previous administrations. Bob Ehrlich's spending went up a lot under him. But spending did go up about 33% under O'Malley. And if you think that we had a $1 billion budget in 1968, and this proposal for the 2017 fiscal year is $42.4 billion. That's what, 48 years or something like that. I mean, that's almost a billion a year. But we know in the last few years it's been more than $2 billion a year. In fact, it was $2 billion a year that it was increased this year. And my guess is it was because of the mandate issue.
If you were governor, what would you do? What specifically would you cut, or what actions would you take, knowing the power of the executive?
One of the things I believe that the governor can still do, and this is a ticklish thing, Hogan is he's very popular. I think he has a chance to win re-election. The only possible candidates that I see that would be popular that could get a Democrat nod would be Congressman Delaney from Montgomery County and Francho. I'm not sure if Francho really wants to run for governor, but Francho votes on the big contracts the same way as Hogan votes, which is really good. He's a liberal, but he says that when he became controller, he began to understand money. Delaney is a businessman, but I think as long as Hogan has pleased the public, he would get the nod again. But if he did some things, like I believe that he could do what Walker did in Wisconsin, which is to say that we will no longer take union money out of paychecks. You'll have to pay those dues on your own. I think a lot of employees would opt not to pay dues. Because I would probably the school funding. I would like to see the school funding really even more turned over locally, turned over from the feds. That department closed. I'd like to see, in a way, the department in the state closed. Our schools were the best when they were locally run, when parents had a say in the schools. So that is really where I would like to see it. Today we have more bureaucracy in the schools, and that's really what we're paying for. I'm not so sure that teacher salaries are going up, but we have a huge bureaucracy. And the same is happening in the college level. We have 29 college campuses of various sorts, from community college to the University of Maryland.
Can the governor cut that bureaucracy?
I would think that he could, but I would think that also, the student loan thing has ruined tuition for kids because it's made it easy to finance college from the back end rather than the front end. And when I went to college, my parents didn't have the money to send three of us to college. So I wound up, I grew up in Bethesda, so I wound up working for a year. I was a clerk typist, and with that money and the money that I was able to earn working in the summers, I put myself almost all the way through college. And I didn't go to Maryland. I went to the University of Illinois, which for me was actually cheaper than Maryland, because I'm so old that the Beltway wasn't in then, and it would have taken me a long time to commute. So that's what I did. But as soon as student loans started becoming available, these kids, and also they weakened the studies in colleges, so that you can study women's studies or black studies or something I can't even think of. I'm picking an ethnic group or a gender group here, but there are many others that they pick because they're interesting, but it's not really going to get them a job in the real world where they could be doing engineering or business. Or
one thing that the governor can alter of significance that would really change the economic dynamic in this state.
At one time, with the Democrat legislature, I would announce that we have to cut, I think you have to bully this. It's like being in a war. And the last wars that we've had, we haven't had a president who has stood up and continuously said why we have to be in the war. Whereas I think Franklin Roosevelt was way out front, why we had to be there, what we were fighting for, and we all knew. I don't think that we really knew what our goals were in our wars in the Middle East recently. So it's like if the governor is going to choose to do something, he needs to be out there in the bully pulpit saying what he wants to do.
And what would you do if you were in that bully pulpit?
I would. He's already started to do some of this, and let's create the committee to look at regulations, and I would wipe out a lot of regulations. And I would ask the legislature, instead of passing new laws, to look at old laws and see what laws they can repeal. And then I would say to the public, we need to get the state off your backs.
And
we are going to cut your income taxes. Those are the most serious taxes, and we're going to cut them. But we're going to get them off your backs in the other ways, so that people can start businesses again and more jobs will be created. So we're going to cut regulations like crazy too. But I need your backing because I can't do this without you. The other side won't let it happen. And that's what he has to do.
I noticed that the expenses of the Maryland Lottery and Game Control Agency were about $1.85 billion this past year. What possible justification could there be for funding consolidating in addition to that?
I'm not sure I heard all the question. So did you see the revenues for the...
They generated almost $1 billion.
Yeah, and what did you say that the expenses were?
What's the justification for such a high expenditure for facilitating?
I think up until recently, the state is owning the slot machines, and they lease the slot machines to the casinos. There are all of these little ins and outs. I don't know how many employees they've brought in, but if they could do it and the money's coming in, they'll bring them in. So I don't know how many employees are involved in the lottery and casino gambling. I just don't know.
To follow up on that, the revenue that is generated, how is that utilized? And as I've heard it, that money is put towards education, but isn't it so that if the money is put towards education, that the money that would normally go to education software?
That's exactly what happened. it was like we were gonna the money for the stadiums. The stadium income was all going to go to education. Everything's for education. But as Spear can tell you, charter schools, which are public schools, don't have quite, I'm just saying, an ounce less of regulation than the regular public schools have, but they don't have the bureaucracy that the public schools have. They get along on, what, two-thirds to three-quarters of what is spent per student in the public? Two-thirds. So, I mean, heck, we could go big time to charter schools and we'd probably have better education.
We would.
Spare something we would.
Well, we've done now with 10 years and we've been number one the whole team.
Yeah.
What's the point of even regulating gambling though? We all know it's back.
They make money at it. It's about the money.
They just want a chunk of it, huh?
Yeah, and you know there's gambleholics out there. This guy's been raising his hand.
I've got a little more radical view. A lot of times everyone's on the stance principle, it's easier to spend someone else's money than it is yours. And I'm a small business, so I have employees. It seems to me that there's an awful lot of people that they're growing up in a generation where they all have their hands out. And they say, you know, government owes me this, I get all these entitlements. If we could get around with the small businesses taking payroll taxes out, and you would have all these 20-year-olds at the end of the month have the right payroll tax checks, I think we'd be a whole lot more conservative. And when they saw the flaw in the weight, they would say, hey, wait a second, why are they doing that? But the way the current system is, where the small business owner is responsible for taking payroll taxes out, we have a generation that doesn't understand what these taxes are or where they're going to, and we get the handout, the entitlement things are expected, but we don't have the conservatives. So is there any way that we could get around or propose a bill where you don't have, if everyone had to pay their own payroll taxes, we have a lot more conservatives. We have a lot less wasteful spending
because
they're spending
their money. Do you think that the legislature and any government is going to allow that to happen? I don't think so. They've talked about it. I mean, I've heard about it.
The technology has changed so much in the last 20 years, it could be done.
Up until World War II, you did not have to pay your income tax at the end of the year. All at once, when World War II broke out, 80% of the people were in their rear. How are you going to lock up 80% of the population? And the guy, I think he worked for Macy's in New York, he said, look, we've got to do it like the Christmas time. They set aside a couple dollars each week, they don't even think about it, and they think they got this big amount of money right at Christmas and they can go splurge. So they took it out on the Christmas time. They literally went through, and for a long time, your employer could do it, but then they did an automatic system pretty much. Today, if you're an employer, and I used to be an employer for years, you have to put in the money, and if Tuesday you have a certain amount of money, you can't wait till the end of the week. The minute you hit that sum, you get penalized if you don't transfer it automatically to the IRS. It is a total totalitarian double wire. There's no way you're going to go. I beat it for about 5 years, and I did it because I started two businesses. I've put the capital up myself.
Did
the
loan.
Huh?
Statute of limitations is not passed. You might want to stop right there.
there's several ways of beating it. What I basically did is I stopped taking an income. And I charged myself interest on these demand loans. But it's difficult, I can tell you right now.
My husband always said to underpay taxes so that you'd always have to pay taxes on April the 15th. And, you know, in California, for a couple of years, sent IOUs because they didn't have the money to refund state tax. So it's something to be aware of.
right now, I'm retired, and I have income coming in, and you do your estimated tax, you have got to be within a certain percent or you get penalized. And like all these IRS, all these accountants, they don't like it, maybe, or maybe they do like it, but they're in debt with the IRS. Well, they're gonna err in the favor of the IRS.
Well, the thing that's going against is that we have to have our policies in line with people that are voting for these policies. So I think if you could change the mind of the people by getting them to pay their own payroll tax, you would get people would be spending less.
Actually, the grassroots stuff really works, I think. And over the last, at least since Ronald Reagan, the grassroots really hasn't worked, and we've been run at all levels by the establishment of both parties, I think. Now, in this very interesting election year, we at least have grassroots. And they're speaking loud and clear that they don't trust the people who are entrenched in Washington. I think any place else, which I think is very interesting. But when grassroots come up with an issue, and it gets resounded and resounded and multiplies and multiplies, sooner or later, I mean, they listen to you. Sooner or later, they listen to you. So far in Maryland, we've been a pretty quiet bunch. One more question. There was somebody here. Back there?
I can just say on the bottom of this paper, www.marylandtaxes.com.
I didn't hear everything you said.
Well, I was saying at the bottom of the paper, the site says MarylandTaxes.com. If you wanted to get into a deeper breakdown of this and find out where this mandate and trust fund money is, find the way. Would that site provide that also?
There are tons of reports, but I'm going to tell you, if you're an accountant, they aren't really great. They raised the alcohol tax to 9%. They had no idea what kind of money they were going to make with the 9%. There is a tax on wholesalers when they sell liquor by the gallon, and then there's a tax in the restaurant or the bar or the liquor store that you go to. That the final retail is the 9% tax. They didn't keep it separate from anything. Right here in this law on the line on income taxes, the corporate taxes are in that line. So you have personal and corporate taxes, and there's no real separation for the many people who have small businesses and pay their taxes through their personal income taxes. That doesn't happen. When they increased the alcohol tax to 9%, they finally had to create a line item for it. So they only have 3 years of information on it. So I think that what happened with the alcohol tax is it really hurt the small retailer. The big chain retailers were getting lower wholesale prices anyway, and it didn't affect them as much. It only affected the final customer. But the smaller guy with one restaurant or, one liquor store, it really has hurt them. And they come and go anyway, so it just made it even harder.
All right, let's give
David
a hand.
Thank you.
We'll take a 5-minute break, and then we'll have David Bowes.